Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio B at Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In tonight's episode, our 30th, we call it Dances with Bees. We head out to Brunnwinkel at Wolfgangsee and walk into the apiary of legendary Carl von Frisch. Stay tuned. Just 30 kilometers east of Salzburg, on the northeast banks of Wolfgang See, or Lake Wolfgang, is a small hamlet called Brunnwinkel. There, if you go, you'll see a plaque commemorating the life and work of Carl von Frisch, the Nobel Prize winner in physiology or medicine for the year 1973. To beekeepers, he's known as the one that decoded the dance language of honeybees. The dance language of the bees is probably most known by the waggle dance, a term used by beekeepers for the figure-eight dance of the honeybee. By performing it, successful foragers can share with other members of the colony spatial information, geographical information about direction and distance to those flowers yielding nectar and pollen, to water sources. Bear in mind, honeybees bring water back to the hive to regulate its temperature, and also to new nest site locations, especially when a colony is looking to swarm. Between this, the waggle dance, and the round dance, we have two forms of communication, of communicating spatial knowledge, of communicating where. Honeybees do this with less than a million neurons in their brain. Tonight, we're going to explore a little bit the legacy of Carl von Frisch, who wrote his first treatise on the honeybee communication back in the 1920s and spent the rest of his working life continuing that exploration there, not only in Brunnwinkel, but here in Austria and in Germany as well. We also have on the show two professors who have spent decades decoding themselves and looking at von Frisch's work, building upon it, as is such in science, to build on the work before you, to question it as well. And we bring on, first, we have Professor Randolph Menzel, the co-author of The Intelligence of Bees, the academic grandson of Carl von Frisch, whose own work has contributed to this body of knowledge regarding bee communication. Specifically, his work looks at the spatial navigation and spatial memory of honeybees and how it is that they are able to remember sort of a landscape, map it out, create a cognitive map. He joins us from Berlin. We've been very interested on the show about, we've been talking about the geographical imagination on this show, and we want to extend that and in this episode, get into the natural sciences a little bit and look at how space is remembered, how spatial information is remembered, how spatial information is communicated. And one of the best species to look at, I guess, has been the honeybee. Where was the start there with the honeybee research in terms of the communication of spatial knowledge? Is it with von Frisch?
Yeah, I think von Frisch was the one who actually discovered the meaning of the waggle dances, or the communication about a place outside of this dark box of such a hive. And he was involved in these studies for a long time, several decades. He first saw it in 1928 and described it as something which is curious, and he thought this is related more to an advertisement for either pollen or nectar. Uh-huh. And later, it took him a long time, actually, until the mid-50s, when he fully described the codes involved. And I'm not degrading this enormous amount of discovery by saying that he had found a wonderful way how we human would interpret the waggle dance. Uh-huh. We could read, and he could read, and his students could read the vector of the outbound flight towards the location indicated by the dance. But it was a very complicated endeavor to show that the bees following a dance, so the recruited bees, would indeed understand it and use it. And the problem was, at this time, one could not follow a bee flying out in the open for several hundred meters or kilometers. And so one needed a lot of additional procedures. And these procedures were questioned, and they were attacked, and they were used to ask whether indeed the bees understand their communication. And it took quite a number. And in fact, we then made a final contribution to this question, because we used a system, harmonic rudder, and that allowed us to follow the bees in free flight over up to 1 kilometer or so, 2 kilometers. Oh. And then we saw indeed the bees which followed the dance, they do exactly what von Frisch proposed, that they understand where to fly, to use the compass, their sound compass, have a measuring device for distance, and then reach that place which was indicated by the dance.
So we have distance and direction. So distance is that being communicated by the vibration of the dance? Is that the distance part, or is that the...
There are several parameters which correlate highly with distance measure. One is the number of waggles. Uh-huh. So, for example, if the bee waggles, let me give you a few numbers, let's say 7 times,
right,
then it means 1 kilometer. And if they waggle 60 times, it means 4.5 kilometers. So each waggle codes for something like 60 meters. Huh. And it's a linear relationship. But there is also the duration of waggling, the waggle run, how long it lasts. And that was the original kind of measure Carl von Frisch did. Uh-huh. And that also correlates very, very nicely with distance.
Yeah. And then direction is, how is that communicated, the direction?
Yeah, direction. I mean, they are in the black box, and they want to use the sound compass for direction when they are in flight. So they have to transpose it into a different reference system, and that is gravity. So they interpret gravity as the direction towards the sun azimuth. That means if a bee dances at 12 o'clock, and the feeding place is in the south, she would directly dance upwards. Okay. Now, since the feeding place is stationary and the sun moves, so they need a clock, and they have a very precise clock. And that means they then change their waggle direction relative to gravity when the sun moves outside.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. If you have a comment about the show, go to the blog section and join the conversation. Thank you. Now let's get back to our episode on bee communication.
Now, you studied, if correct me if I get this wrong, but you studied with Martin Lindauer, who was a PhD student of von Frisch. So you sort of are in the same lineage, so to speak, intellectual or academic lineage. Did you ever meet von Frisch?
I met von Frisch twice, one when he gave a wonderful lecture and once when I did my PhD and I had my defense first at the university in Frankfurt with Lindauer. And then von Frisch had the tradition to invite everybody to his house. And these people who did a PhD, let's say in 1 year, they gathered together with him. And he, in fact, ran another exam. And so we had to pass an exam with von Frisch. And that was not such an easy task. He was rather critical and a very careful and thorough person. And he asked us important questions.
I've read a little bit about your account of this in a publication. Did he ask you a question about sort of hitchhiker bees, bees that go on to other bees between flowers or something along those lines?
Yeah. I got a question. In fact, I must say I failed in this exam because von Frisch asked me a question which I could not answer. And the question was, how do bees come from flower to flower without moving their bodies?
Right.
And I said, this must be a joke. He's probably joking. And since when we say bees, we usually think only about honeybees.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
There are 20,000 species of solitary bees. And there are tiny little solitary bees, and they clamp to the legs of honeybees, and they let them transport one flower to the other. And I did not know about this. And so I just tried to escape by making one or the other. He became more and more angry and said, no, it's a serious question. And so I could not escape. And then I had to say, okay, so please tell me, what is the answer to your question?
So it was a trick question in some way.
It was a trick question. Particularly, the situation was, in fact, a fun situation. We were kind of outside of the university. It was not a serious exam. It was something like a ceremony with a famous person and these little new students. And so I didn't fully understand whether he meant it seriously or he wanted to make a joke.
You're saying a famous person. Was von Frisch at that time when you met him in Wolfgang See, was he famous by then? I mean, had he won the Nobel Prize?
He was the hero of our biology study. He was the hero for us and all the people working with bees. Anyhow, he was the one who made all these major discoveries throughout the whole century of the 20th century. So, no, this is without question. He was also a very, very impressive person. He gave wonderful, highly impressive lectures, and he had a large school. And Martin Lindauer, our supervisor, was his main offspring, to say, in his research. So we had a very close connection in this dynasty von Frisch honeybee students.
Yeah. Now, you've just sort of completed 50 years since your PhD in 2016, or at the end of 2015, you finished a book, and then it was published, I believe, in 2016, in English, called The Intelligence of Bees. I find interesting you worked with Matthias Eckhold, a science journalist, so really taking the science and making it available to the public in more of a journalistic fashion. I think that's how we define this show, is taking sort of geographical research and making it more public. This book, though, is this the culmination of 50 years of work? Is that how you think of it?
Yeah, I would say it is it's a compilation of what I did. It is a selection based on the areas to which I contributed throughout my research life. It is certainly not the full coverage of all what is honeybee research about. It's very selected, with respect to my own interest. And in fact, the whole story of dance communication came to me very late in my research work. I was much more concerned about learning and memory and color vision and olfaction and the neural substrate of all of this. And only more lately, when I thought more carefully about this, let's say, the more cognitive components of honeybee behavior, when I thought more carefully about the structure of complex forms of memory, let's say memory which results from rule learning or memory resulting from exploratory learning, then I developed more and more interest in this fantastic way of learning from each other within the same species. So an insect which teaches its companions in a social context, using a symbolic form of communication in which there is not a simple kind of relationship or connection between a learning task, let's say something like a physical stimulus, which is then rewarded or punished, but something in which the stimulus taken up by the receiving animal is a complex mess from another animal, and there is no reward involved. The animals learn by self-motivation. And this fascinated me more and more, and I must say, it is still an enormous secret how they do it with a rather small brain, with less than a million neurons.
Right.
We have no idea what the neural structure might be of this dance communication and the neural structure of the special memory to which they refer when they apply this kind of symbolic message.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. If you have a comment about the show, go to the blog section and join the conversation. Now let's get back to our episode on bee communication.
Okay, so when you say spatial memory, let's kind of walk through.
The bees need to learn about the landscape around the hive first during their exploratory flights. They do not collect any food.
Okay.
They collect information
when
they fly out the first time. And we have been looking into this orientation flights, these explorations, very carefully. And they apply a very interesting strategy. They fly at different distances in different directions, in sequential flights. They learn about the sun compass at the location. They learn about, they calibrate their watch. They learn about the landscape structure. And the kind of memory developed during this exploration is a memory which I do not hesitate to call a cognitive map, because we have rather strong evidence that the animals are able to make shortcut flights between locations which they can select from their memory. And in that sense, they have some form of spatial layout stored in their memory, which is best described as a geometric form of arrangement of identified objects, discriminated objects. And now the question for me, unsolved so far, or only partly solved, is the question whether they refer to this form of memory, this kind of geometric map-like memory, when they perform their Wegeldance communication. And certainly the main message transmitted during the Wegeldance is a vector. And the vector does not require a spatial layout of a map. It can be just the distance and direction. And the question is whether there is something in addition, whether they embed the vector from the dance communication into their spatial memory.
If you were to take a beehive, which happens quite often, and they get moved. So I'm thinking of, let's just think of a commercial bee enterprise. And so they're going to move bees according to a pollinization schedule or something along those lines. And so you move the bees in a truck, multiple hives, and you bring them to the new site. So the bees, and ideally overnight, which is what happens a lot, they'll be put in their spot. And then in the morning, those bees are going to realize initially that they're not in the same place they were before, and then have to remap. Is that basically, they have to remap?
Exactly.
Yeah, and create a new base map.
Yeah. I mean, when they have established their map and they have learned about the sound compass and the distance estimation system, and then have already foraged at a particular place, and the beekeeper transports the colony to another place, then it takes them again exploration. They make exploratory flights. They learn about the new place very quickly. They do not take so long as during the very first exploration. Only two or three flights are sufficient to become familiar with the new place.
Uh-huh.
And then because the sound compass exists already, I mean, if we would transport, let's say, a colony from south of the equator to north of the equator, a wonderful experiment which has been done with Martin Lindauer, and then you transport them over several hundred or thousand kilometers across the equator, then everything is wrong. I mean, the equator, the sun compass is wrong.
Uh-huh.
The sun was in the north, and now it's in the south. And so these bees, Lindauer said, they cannot learn a new compass after they have learned the compass. The colony relies on new bees coming out, young bees coming out, making their first orientation flight at the new place. I think this question should be studied once more, whether the experienced bees cannot relearn also the sound compass system. That would be very interesting. But on the other side, if such a drastic change is not the case, and only, let's say, a time shift, there's a jet lag, you transport a colony from Berlin to New York, then they adjust very quickly, it takes them a few days, and they have the sound compass again right, as we do, and then they are fine, and they can learn the landscape in the new area very quickly.
Yeah.
But usually a beekeeper transports the colonies only over short distances, let's say 100 kilometers.
Right.
In that context, such a change is not drastic enough to readjust the sun compass system, and they only have to learn the new landscape structure. And we did this in our experiments, and we found that as they when they do this reorientation, it takes them much faster than when they do the initial orientation.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. So welcome back to Dances with Bees. I think quite fascinating, this idea of creating a base map that bees will look for landmarks, look for the horizon, look for a whole wide range of elements that go into then producing this cognitive map that then they can communicate through the dance language. And I'm even missing the point. I think it's so complex. And that complexity sometimes is hard to communicate. And tonight, in our second interview, we're actually moving into, we're going to continue to talk about the legacy of Carl von Frisch, but I also want to talk about the importance of being able to communicate science to a wider public and communicate it in a way that is, understandable beyond the sort of doors of the academic conference where everyone is speaking in specialized language. And our second guest is Dr. Jürgen Tautz, coming from Würzburg University in Germany. And he has been, is widely known for his career in sciences, especially with bee research. But then taking that research and taking the things he's finding and making them more public, first in a book about 10 years ago came out, The Buzz About Bees, The Biology of a Superorganism, really brought to the kitchen table in some ways ideas of this superorganism, that the hive works collectively in this decision-making and in its hierarchy is much flatter. Now, 10 years later, he's coming out with his second book this month, April 2017, and it's called, the English translation would be The Honey Factory. And we want to talk to him about his work as a public scientist in many ways, still with an academic post and still with a very rigorous research agenda, but one who speaks to the wider audience and, in fact, was honored in 2012 by, I suppose, the German Academy of Sciences, the equivalent, the 2012 Communicator Prize for this work. And you could also find some of this public science work on his website, Hobos. And we speak to him on the phone, and I wanted to first ask about how important it really is to bridge the sort of scientific research and its language and communicate it then to the rest of the hive. How important is it to actually bridge research findings to a more general audience and a general public that could understand that, for instance, von Frisch's work is much more than we reduce it down to maybe a dance, but actually it's much more complex than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the point or the issue that you are addressing at the moment is at least in my view, very important, really, really relevant. I mean, it has a lot of very important aspects. So one, for example, is that if we are concerned at least a little bit about the future of our biosphere, of human mankind, then you should try to get to make people aware of problems, to make people maybe even change even little details in their daily behavior, right, and so on and so on. And before such decisions are being made made by individuals, they need to know. And they need to know first what the current state in any science might be, and second, the way how this insights and hypotheses and ideas and facts are being created. And I think even in times, especially in times in which we are living at the moment, like the post-factual times, where people can be influenced easily by non-based statements, it's even more important to train people, beginning with little children, which criteria will help them to first distinguish invented statements from real facts. And if you find, if you are lucky enough and work in a field like in the field of honeybees, which make it easy to get people interested, then you have an ideal tool and an ideal bridge into the head of even young people to transport your messages.
You have a book that came out a few years back that's been extremely popular. The English translation is The Buzz About Bees, The Biology of a Superorganism. And you're really proposing, I guess, through the bees, a different way of thinking. And that's, you know, important, because I think you're also getting people or asking people to shift some of their assumptions or previous misconceptions about biology. And so what is this, the superorganism? Is this a different way of thinking about social insects, or is it a different way of thinking about many different species in general?
So as a scientist, you in first hand you have to stick to the facts. Yeah, you study such superorganisms like honeybees and wasps and bumblebees and ants and termites,
uh-huh,
and you try to figure out what holds them together, how they organize each other, how they communicate. What might be the genetic basis of their colony, that might be the route which led through evolution to what we find nowadays. But then it's very tempting to look at superorganisms at very successful results of natural selection and compare them with other organisms living socially, like us humans, and see what if we may even be able to learn from them, not in a very primitive way in copying,
right,
but maybe to think about certain principles after which we organize our communities.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. If you have a comment about the show,
go to the blog section and join the conversation. Now let's get back to our episode on bee communication. In terms of feedback that you've gotten from the public about that book, what are some of the, I don't know, what's the one connection that maybe people point out the most between humans and honeybees or other social insects?
One aspect is that super organisms like honeybees are organized in a flat hierarchy, so the ways how they make decisions are such that the risk of making wrong decisions and going in a totally wrong directions is minimal. Huh. So not like in us humans in most companies and in administration, top-down decisions, where one wrong or unable individual could make big damages to the society. It's different in these, so they are safe against such risks and such problems, and there are more such ideas one can get.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a sort of a checks and balances, or in that decision making.
So if you make a very rough and easy comparison between decisions based on collective interactions, like in bee colonies, and we may call this swarm intelligence on the one hand, and individual decisions in hierarchically organized systems or societies, then you see, for example, that if individuals make decisions for the rest of the society, they are very limited in the amount of information that is available to these individuals.
Yeah.
This is different in a honeybee colony. So the colony altogether has all the information available they need. Then, if individuals make decisions, no consensus is possible. In swarm intelligence, consensus can be the result of very tricky information routes and feedbacks. And in individual decisions, there are only very weak feedbacks in failure decisions, yeah, in wrong decisions. And in those insects, they are strong feedbacks if they would make a wrong decision. And again, individual decisions, non-informed or poorly informed, individuals can make big damage to the whole society. And in honeybee colonies, non-informed individuals don't make any harm to the others. So they just exist, but that's it. So I may add another aspect. I just had presented in a talk, I guess, 2 days ago.
Uh-huh.
So in today's industry companies, it's common in banks as well, so everywhere where money is important, it's common that the so-called efficiency of the whole structure or the organization is tried to improve by getting rid of non-employed individuals. So in the individuals that are not needed at the moment, which the support of which is not needed at the moment,
right?
They are released. And the secret in honeybees is how I call the silent reserve. Yeah, so most of them don't do anything most of the time, but if they are needed, they are present, and the superorganism can act instantly with full power and optimal adapted to the needs. And so this may be maybe also a lesson for human societies, that one shall be more patient also with oneself. Yeah, if not everyone has a lot of work to do at the moment, the situation will change, and the bees are prepared for such changes.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode? Want to talk about what it means to do public geography? Do you want to shape your own city and look at your own city's shape? Give us a call. Let's talk about building an episode together. Now let's get back to our bees. You know, part of the reason we're speaking today is to discuss the book a little bit, and it's called... I'm assuming that, will the English translation, title translation, be The Honey Factory? Is that the...
Yes.
It's being published first in German, then it's going to be published in English.
Yes.
The Honey Factory, is this coming off the heels of the success of your previous book, The Buzz About Bees, and you finding sort of this broader audience?
It's not as simple as this. So the book The Buzz About Bees is describing the life of the bees and the superorganism as if the world would be perfect, as if no humans would exist, but as if the bees are just on themselves. Going deep into the inner world of the bee life.
Yeah.
And the new book, The Honey Factory, and I purposely waited now exactly 10 years between these two books, is describing humans and bees. So that the common history, how we came along, humans and bees until today, and even more important, drawing some pictures and raising some ideas about the future of this going together and of this mutual interdependence of both.
We think of them as an indicator species. They're giving us clues to the overall health of our biosphere, the overall health of our local and regional environments.
So these very important, objectively very important aspects, luckily enough, meet the fact that honeybees are looked upon very sympathetic animals by most people. So, you can show very easily, and this was one of the first scientific achievements by Charles Darwin, that earthworms, for example, they are very important for agriculture, for forming mold, and so on. So any garden needs earthworms. that you never would be able to make people alert and positive and raise a positive attitude towards earthworms like you can do with honeybees.
Right. If people wanted to find out more, if listeners wanted to find out more, they could explore your website. You run a project of sort of a public, you know, we talk about doing public geography here, but here doing sort of public science work and reaching out to the broader audience. It's called HOBOS, is that correct? What does that stand for, the acronym?
So HOBOS, this five letters are shortening from Honeybee Online Studies.
Uh-huh.
And what lays behind is at the moment three honeybee hives, and soon a fourth one we will put up in Bournemouth in England, which are equipped with high technology and getting a lot of live videos, live data, which we present in the internet, and it is like a laboratory, free for everyone, open for everyone, so everyone can use this as for doing scientific work if one wants to, and there are quite some new observations and new facts we didn't know before, done by the users of HOBOS. Like one user discovered a new sleeping position by the bees night. And so the clue is that the HOBOS bees are not disturbed.
Yeah.
So even the study that Carl von Frisch did, and we also did, until HOBOS, we disturbed the bees. So if you want to see them, you have to open the colony, you have to shine light in, and this is disturbance. And if you have no way of any of comparing what you see to an undisturbed situation, you have no idea what percentage of the behavior you are observing is not natural and what was made by you or elicited by you as an observer.
Right.
And in HOBOS, we have kids with these as they do it, as they live naturally in total darkness. They use by endoscopes, light waves, light wavelengths, which cannot be seen by the bees, so they are not disturbed in any way. And most of it, we have created this HOBOS platform as a teaching tool for schools, for any kind of school, for any grade, and even for different fields, like people doing geography or mathematics or informatics, can start with this, and then if you begin with bees, you only need two or three steps maximally, and you are at any topic you want to deal with.
Yeah. Huh. Last question. How diverse are your audiences? So you're being invited to speak to different groups. What kind of groups seek you out? I'm imagining it's not just people interested in biology. It's actually much more than that.
Yeah, so and if you try to spread ideas and raise interest in people on certain aspects like and the life of honeybees, you try to aim as wide as possible. And so I'm very, very happy that this goes well with honeybees. So if I give talks, there are sometimes even very, very young children in there, in the audience, and this makes me very happy to realize that they don't get uneasy after 10 minutes, but they are very, very attentive till the end, and older people and scientists, non-scientists, people interested in nature in general, And so really, you cannot nail it down to a specific group of people being interested.
Yeah. Do companies, have you ever been invited by a company to talk about the hierarchies and that
yeah,
angle?
Yeah, it also happens occasionally, management meetings, yeah, and companies, like you say, and communication, companies like television stations which will want to let their employees informed about certain things.
Yeah.
So it's very, very interesting what kind of people and organizations you come across and what kind of contacts you get. And again, this earth worms, it would never work like this.
right. Yeah, people are more interested in honeybees. So we've come to the end of another radio expedition into the geographies of everything and nothing. Tonight, looking at honeybee spatial navigation, perhaps gives us a little bit to think about our own human spatial navigation, how we get from A to B, how we remember that. I want to thank Professors Menzel and Touts for sharing their keen insights after decades dedicated to these kinds of questions and dedicated to doing science, bringing those ideas to the public through this show, but also through their different publications, helping us better understand the world in which we live and imagining that world in different ways. As always, I'd like to thank Mike Allen for allowing us to use his song Sand Dune as our show ID. Looking forward to putting together our next episode here in Salzburg for May 2017. Stay tuned. Check us out on the web, www.geographicalimaginations.org. Ciao.